Want to write a novel but not sure where to start? Grab a copy of my free Story Starter Kit workbook by going to savannahgilbo.com/starter-kit. In this free multi-page guide, I'll walk you through the first 5 questions to ask and answer before writing any story. You'll get clarity on your characters, your setting, your theme, your plot, and so much more. So one more time, go to savannahgilbo.com/starter-kit to grab your free copy.
So commercially, this, I looked it up, it's technically marketed as an adult fantasy novel, which, you know, the first thing we want to look at when it comes to commercial genre is, do we get a sense of that in this opening chapter? I think we do. There's multiple things that, in my opinion, show the magical side of it. So obviously, Quentin's doing a lot of thinking about Fillory and Further, where kids literally go to a magical land. He's, you know, checking out cabinets in a real home to see if he can go to Fillory. He's doing magic tricks in his pockets. That's like a different element of magic.
Welcome to the Fiction Writing Made Easy podcast. My name is Savannah Gilbo, and I'm here to help you write a story that works. I want to prove to you that writing a novel doesn't have to be overwhelming. So each week, I'll bring you a brand new episode with simple, actionable, and step-by-step strategies that you can implement in your writing right away. So whether you're brand new to writing or more of a seasoned author looking to improve your craft, this podcast is for you. So pick up a pen and let's get started. In today's episode, we're diving deep into the first chapter of The Magicians by Lev Grossman, and I'm super excited to share this episode with you because this is one of my favorite book series, and it was both challenging and fun to break down this first chapter. So as usual with these first chapter episodes, I had a special guest. Her name is Abigail K. Perry, and she's a developmental editor, a book coach, and the host of an amazing podcast called Lit Match, where she helps writers find the best literary agent for their writing and publishing careers. I'm going to link to her podcast in the show notes, as well as where you can find Abigail around the internet if you want to get in touch with her. Now, if you've been listening to this podcast for a while, then you already know the deal about these first chapter episodes. But just in case you're brand new or in case you need a reminder, Abigail and I like to pick apart the opening chapters of stories to see how the author hooks our attention and pulls us into the story. And we like to analyze these opening chapters on both the macro and the micro level. So basically, we're asking, why does this chapter work? And then how does the scene or how do the multiple scenes within that first chapter work? So that's a very, very quick overview of what we're going to dig into today. You will hear more explanation for everything as we get into the episode. So with that being said, let's go ahead and dive right into the conversation.
Hey, Savannah, thanks so much for joining me for this amazing episode. We are going to take another deep dive analysis into a first chapter. And before we do that, I'm sure people will hear this. I have a scratchy voice today. I'm sure I'm getting over some sort of preschool germs that have happened. So sorry if my voice cuts out at some point, but luckily I have the amazing Savannah here with me. So we are going to hash out the first chapter of Lev Grossman's The Magicians. Yeah. And I know that this is a super popular book. This is a book that I read many, many, many years ago now. I'd have to look at when this is even copyright, but it was more towards the beginning of its publishing.
Yeah, I think it was 2009.
2009. Okay. So I think I probably read it in like the 2011, 2012 time. And I have not read it since then. So I read the first chapter again, obviously in preparation for this, but it is a doozy, as Savannah had mentioned to me when we were first getting on. So thanks, Savannah. This is going to be fun to, you know, chat about and pull apart together.
Sure. And it's so funny because I'm coming to it a little bit from the opposite angle where I love this series. I love this book. I love the show. Kind of super obsessed with it. I think about it often, even though there are things like, you know, no story's perfect, but there's a lot in these books that I love. And so I'm coming at it from kind of the nerd angle, which will be fun because we're going to see not only was this a hard chapter to analyze, which we haven't really done much preparation and you'll hear that. We wanted to kind of hash it out during the episode to show you that we also struggle with this stuff. But also we're coming at it from two different perspectives, which I think is super fun. So like Abigail said, she knows the story, but it's been a long time. So she's coming at it with more of fresh eyes. And then I'm coming at it from being in the weeds. So we'll see kind of where we, you know, find similar things, find different things, and it'll be fun.
And I really like when we pair up and when we do first chapters with those different perspectives, because as a writer, when I'm thinking about, you know, all you writers out there who are listening to this, you have those books that you absolutely love that you've read multiple times before. And then you read the first chapter and you're going to just naturally pick up on details, setups, important, like even just one-liners that have significance into the story later. And that can influence how you might dissect the first chapter or the first scene. And then there's, of course, the first-time readers or the, you know, second-time readers, maybe you haven't read it in a while, like me. And that is really cool because you have this opportunity to dive into the story and ask yourself, what really were you drawn to? What is really standing out as a strong first chapter for you? And then through discussion, we can talk about, but why is this a great execution and introduction to what this story is really about? So it's fun to have the different perspectives.
And the other thing I'll say on that too, it's we were doing a scene analysis in my Story Lab membership the other day. So shout out to everybody in my Story Lab membership. And we were just talking about how interesting it is if you haven't read the whole story and you're looking at, let's say, the first chapter, you'll get caught in kind of the surface level of what's happening. But if you've read it more than once, or let's say it's your story that you're trying to craft and analyze, then you can get to that deeper level of understanding. But there is a risk because at some point it's like you've been with the material for so long that it becomes really hard to see, you know, the different pieces. So I just think the whole thing's fascinating, but I also love coming at it from these two perspectives for the same reason you said.
Definitely. Yeah. So Savannah, before we go into the analysis, and I know that you've written a summary, so we're going to talk about the summary before we go into the first chapter. For those out there who don't know what The Magicians is, or that, you know, that this is the first book in a series, but who don't know this first book or don't know what the series is, could you give a brief description about what the story is about?
Yeah. So in its like most simple form, it's about a guy named Quentin Coldwater. I believe he's 17, but they're getting ready to go to college and they stumble into this other world. It's a portal fantasy and they end up going to a school to become magicians. So instead of going on like, you know, the Yale track or whatever, Princeton, they end up going to school to become magicians. And then as they're there, they get into kind of magical, you know, adventures and then things. And they end up in a land called Fillory, which is from a popular book series in the book. So in The Magicians, there's a book series called Fillory and Further. And they end up visiting that land and, you know, having magical adventures there. But what is operating underneath all that fun stuff is that Quentin is he's an unhappy guy. He's arguably dealing with depression and anxiety and stuff like that. So the story's about, is he going to find happiness in his own world? Is Fillory going to be the answer, which he thinks it's going to be? Or like, how is he going to deal with these feelings of depression and unhappiness when he gets kind of a chance that all of us readers, we all might want, right? Like, gosh, we wish we could escape to a magical world to escape our problems sometimes, right? But we'll see through Quentin's story, if you read the book, that it's not always the case.
Yeah. And I think that's, you know, when I picked up this book, you and I both love Harry Potter, Savannah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyone who knows this knows that we are obsessed with Harry Potter. And I would say that when you're looking for, okay, I want a book like Harry Potter, people tend to recommend The Magicians. And at least like that's, I know how it got recommended to me. And a lot of that, I think, is because of the school system. Like, we're entering another school system based in magic. We'll probably get into this when we talk about what type of story this is. But it's interesting because we have an older audience. Like, we have an older, you know, like you said, Quentin's dealing with big internal struggles. And not that, you know, Harry Potter's not. But he's dealing with a different age group, I would say, of internal struggles. And we get that pretty much in the first chapter. So that's pretty cool as well. And I know that you have some thoughts on genre. So why don't we go ahead and get into the summary and get into the questions so that we can explore those ideas.
Sure. So I'll just read a quick summary of the first chapter. And it's not a fast chapter. It's like 5,000-7,000 words. So it's a doozy of a first chapter, but there are multiple scenes in it, which we'll see in a second. But basically, Quentin Coldwater, he's walking through Brooklyn with his two friends, James and Julia. And internally, he's reflecting on, like, why is he so unhappy? So he's thinking about all this stuff as Quentin and James are they're about to do their alumni interview with this alumni from Princeton. And then Julia is going to head back to the library kind of once she drops him off on the doorstep. So meanwhile, Quentin's thinking about, you know, why am I so happy or unhappy? And part of it is because James and Julia are together. So that's a fact that Quentin dislikes because he's attracted to Julia and he knows she's never going to reciprocate. And also Quentin, objectively, he knows he should be happy. So he's like, I come from a reasonably good middle-class home. I have decent parents. I have good friends, you know, despite my very high GPA. And he says, performing all the rituals and sacrifices necessary to be happy, he's not. And so we learn through his thoughts that he believes there must be more to life, and his thoughts drift to his favorite fantasy book series, Fillory and Further. And he, you know, he's thinking about these books. We learn there are five in total. They follow the adventures of the five Chatwin children as they go from our world to the land of Fillory. And then we realize that though Quentin's almost an adult, he's super engrossed by these books, and he often escapes into the world of Fillory when he finds real life too difficult to cope with. So that's kind of all going on as they're on their way to this building, apartment building, whatever, to interview with the guy from Princeton. So once they arrive, Julia leaves for the library, and Quentin and James knock on the door. Nobody answers. And then when they knock a second time, the door kind of creaks open, and Quentin wanders in because he's pulled forward by this secret hope that, you know, this is how it starts in the Fillory books. Something strange happens, and then they find a cabinet or a clock, and the kids go through and they're taken to Fillory. So he's kind of driven by this motivation that he can't quite admit. And then he wanders around the house. James is still on the doorstep, and he goes up to a cabinet. He tries to open the back, thinking he's going to go to Fillory. And then he's disappointed when he can't, or when it doesn't open. And then he turns around and he spots a dead body on the floor of the den in the house. And then we learn that 15 minutes later, paramedics arrive, and one of the paramedics tells Quentin the man died of a cerebral hemorrhage, so there was kind of nothing they could do. And then she hands Quentin and James each an envelope with their name on it, but only Quentin agrees to take his. And then, so, you know, fast forward a little bit, they leave the house. Quentin and James separate. They're both grumpy. James goes to the library to find Julia, and Quentin decides he's going to look in his envelope. And then to his surprise, he finds a manuscript that's titled The Magician's Book 6 of Fillory and Further. So, of course, he's very interested. And as he turns that front page to read it, there's a note inside, but before he can read it, it gets picked up by the wind. So then he's, you know, following this piece of paper as it blows around the streets of Brooklyn, and he follows it into a neglected garden, and he's kind of walking through bramble and getting hurt and all this stuff. And then he notices that things are quiet and the din of the city is gone. He feels super nauseous and he closes his eyes, even though he's like, you know, still going forward. And when he opens them, he finds himself under a deep or a blue sky, staring at a great green lawn and a large stone house. So he's totally been transported somewhere different. There's a kid, a teenager there when he pops out, and Quentin says, is this Fillory? And the boy says, no, this is upstate New York. And that's where the chapter ends.
Yeah. I love that ending too.
Me too.
I love that last line. Okay. Awesome. So as usual in our deep dive analysis episodes, we will go through the 7 key first chapter questions first. So we're looking at big picture at all of these. How is this first chapter hooking readers, getting us to read more, because it is satisfying, you know, these 7 key first chapter questions, which come from Paula Munay's The Writer's Guide to Beginnings. So we love to do it that way. And then we're going to zero in and we'll look at the micro story. So we'll start to look at scene structure. Lots of interesting discussion to come with that, because this is a very challenging first chapter to analyze by scene level. But obviously, it has masterful scenes. So we'll get into that. Let's go ahead and move into the seven first chapter questions. So the first of these is dealing with genre. And the question is, what kind of story is this?
Right.
And so, of course, like, we usually talk about two types of genres, content genre and commercial genre. So Savannah, first, what is the commercial genre for this? How would we market this? Yeah. And then let's move into content genre, meaning what is the story really about? Like, well, that's the next question, actually. But
yeah,
what kind of story is this? on
content wise.
Yeah. On, yeah. Right. Content wise on that deep level.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So commercially, this, I looked it up. It's technically marketed as an adult fantasy novel, which, you know, the first thing we want to look at when it comes to commercial genre is, do we get a sense of that in these, in this opening chapter? I think we do. There's multiple things that, in my opinion, show the magical side of it. So obviously, Quentin's doing a lot of thinking about Fillory and Further, where kids literally go to a magical land. He's, you know, checking out cabinets in a real home to see if he can go to Fillory. He's doing magic tricks in his pockets. That's like a different element of magic. The way the paramedic interacts with him, you can tell something's up. We just don't quite know what. She's very makes light of the situation. Like, yeah, we're not supposed to let the people die, but, you know, sometimes it happens. There's little things. And then obviously he pops out in a totally different climate under a different sky. So I think there's a lot that points to the fantasy element and also the adult age range, kind of like we talked about earlier, the heavy topics, the age of the protagonist and things like that.
Yeah. And I think that being listed as adult fantasy, I think that's something interesting that I want to talk about quickly, because when I originally read this, there was a category called new adult.
Yeah.
And I would have placed this one in that. And new adult is kind of that in between age for the protagonist and for the reader, for the target reader, more like that college level.
Right.
And this is Quentin. He's interviewing for Princeton. So we know that he's heading into more of the college education level versus the high school level. We're not really in young adult, but we're not quite in the adult area of maturity either. And that sense, you know, since then, I think that that category has, it's like, if you say new adult, people still understand what it is, but I don't think it's quite pitched or existing as much anymore. Would you agree with that, Savannah?
I do. And so I love new adult. I'm a firm believer that there is a new adult category and that the readers want it. I think for some reason, publishers just aren't there yet. And I don't understand why. I mean, I just Googled to see, I wanted to get us a definition. So this says the protagonists are 18 to 29, but, you know, loose on that, right? So it's older than young adult, like Abigail said, but it's less than typical adult, or it can be. And these could be things. So like Jennifer Armentrout, Sarah J. Maas, even they have Colleen Hoover listed on here. So, I mean, Casey McQuiston's Red, White, and Royal Blue. So there's a, you know, a ton of things that are super popular in this category. But yeah, I agree with you. For some reason, it's just kind of not technically,
so it's
with
being
publishers becoming a thing.
Right. Like, it's being listed as adult. But what we're really dealing with here in this age group is that we're dealing with protagonists who have, are in the real world now, but haven't quite figured it out.
Right.
Not that a 30-year-old has figured it out either. I'm in my 30s and I have not figured it out.
Right.
but I'll just say, like, that it is this, it's this kind of, all right, we have left innocence and we're into this new area where we're breaking that innocence. It still exists a little bit, but it's being broken more so. And just like, you know, we still have these big coming of age moments. And I, like, I'm a firm believer that you can have a coming of age experience at any time in your life.
Me too.
At any decade. But when we think traditionally of coming of age, I think that you think the younger years, like you're thinking more of those high school years. You know, those, you know, young years, those middle grade years. And then especially here, I think sometimes you have the rudest awakenings when you actually enter the in this college-esque time, these 20s. So yeah, I mean, all that to say, I'm rambling a little bit, but I think that this is why when someone would say to me, oh, well, you want another Harry Potter, go try this one, but it's for the older audience, which is also really strategic in how this was placed. Because if you look at publishing, like you had, I grew up with Harry Potter, Savannah grew up with Harry Potter as we were aging with Harry. And then it was like, wait, what's next? And here comes the magicians. So I think that that's just something interesting to think about when I'm thinking what kind of story this is. Definitely fantasy. But the other thing that I think is really interesting, because when we were learning about Fillory and to me, when I'm reading about Quentin's obsession with Fillory, immediately just the way that there are the portals, I think, because this is where I was and like what I would have fantasized with, I'm thinking C.S. Lewis. I'm thinking Chronicles of Narnia. So that felt really reminiscent of A Chronicles of Narnia to me, and how Quentin will discuss about how, you know, being the nerd and being obsessed with it. He has a line in there somewhere about why Julia will never go for him. And he's like, partly because of his obsession with Fillory. And it's not necessarily that reason, but I think it's the idea that he needs to go to this other world when he is feeling down.
Right.
And that's also very relatable for a lot of readers, especially fantasy readers.
Right.
And we'll talk about that when we kind of get to the character, but we know that there are fantasy. I'm getting to this point because we know that there are fantasy elements. We know that there are going to be magical elements. Exactly what you said. We can tell some things are off based on how the scene progresses because of his fascination with magic, with these portals,
right,
with these other worlds. So we know that's going there. What I think is so interesting is that the actual first page doesn't really give hints of fantasy. It takes a couple of pages to get into the fantasy. The actual first page really grounds us in, I would say, voice and character.
Right.
And how Lev Grossman is leaning on his strength of just really writing style and how he can pull us in with the voice through the interiority of Quentin. And I think that that's really interesting because that makes it very emotional to me. So when we talk about content genre, I'm leaning into that worldview area. And Savannah, you had mentioned that off podcast that you felt this is really a worldview story as well. And I feel that. I feel that emotional connection, like very internally. The struggles, the emotional struggles here are going to be a big gameplay in how this story is executed. And that's really what the first chapter felt like. It went in, I mean, the first page felt like it focused the most on. And then as you get into it, you can tell we're going to have these, you know, action stakes as well. When you get to the dead body, that's interesting because like the way the line is delivered, you're thinking, wait a second, is there a crime in here? And, you know, and then you explore, no, it's the cerebral hemorrhage, but is it? Right. So like that, right. I think that's something to be thinking about. So, but you can see like there are going to be lots of stakes for genre, but there's a lot going on in this first chapter that captures us as a reader on multiple levels. And we know it's fantasy. We're satisfied as fantasy because especially at the end of that chapter, when you move into the very fantastical, like portal experience, yeah, right? We know we're here. Fantasy readers are satisfied because of that. But I think that this first chapter's expectations promise something much deeper than just the fun of fantasy. And we can be here. We can, you know, buckle your seatbelts for the fun ride of just a fantasy story. And that just, I can put in quotes because nothing is ever just a story. But to kind of get into that idea of, yes, like we have checked off the box that there's something magical here. Yet I think that the emotional story is extremely loud and you cannot ignore that because of how grounded we are in what Quentin is struggling with internally, his depression, his sadness, and a lot of it too, like his concentration, what he focuses on. He's a, you know, coming on a 20-year-old boy and he's thinking about girls, right? So, you know, we have a lot with that. And it's the level, going back to that category of new adult versus young adult, not that this is the only deciphering, you know, not that this is only the only difference that deciphers YA versus new adult or adult, but the sophistication of one person wanting to be with another person is deeper. Like they even talk about, sleeping with one another.
Right.
So it's not that obviously you can't have sex in young adult books, but we can see that there is a more deep rooted level of intimacy between what Quentin wants and what he feels like he can't have,
right,
and how much that consumes him in this age group. So I think that that's something to pay attention to as well.
Yeah. And I want to add two things to that. So the first is the very first line is Quentin did a magic trick nobody noticed. So it's funny that even though we're not getting like fantasy magic necessarily, we're showing that this is a kid. And then, I mean, he does magic, this exact kind of magic trick to impress the people at Breakbills. It's just they have different expectations of what that trick is going to mean. But it is kind of funny, like it's just a unique way to get in magic without it being like the fantasy magic. The other thing I think, it's so funny because for me as a reader, I really relate to Quentin in the sense that, like, honestly, I still wish my Hogwarts letter would show up. Okay. I'm in my mid-30s. I still wish it would come. I still wish, I'm like Quentin, I would discover a cabinet that takes me to a different world. Like, I don't know what that says about me, but I relate so much to him as a fantasy reader. So when I see his longings, I'm like, I get you. I feel like this, I'm in the fantasy world kind of with you, you know? So that to me was like a signal that this is also going to be fantasy because this is what he's focused on. So
what was it? Was it John Truby who did The Anatomy of Genre? Is that what?
Yes.
Yeah. What did he say about fantasy books? People who love fantasy. Do you remember?
It was something like, I'm totally going to butcher this. So like, not only do we like the wonder and the things like that, but we have visions and passions about the world becoming a better place. So yeah. It's like, I don't know what I want to say, but not that we're idealists, but like we really just want the world to become a better place, and fantasy helps us explore and realize like what could be possible.
Yes. Yeah. And I relate to that as well, because I am in with you right there, Savannah, and that I want my Hogwarts letter. I want the portal, the sense of escapism.
Yeah.
Right? Escapism. I'm not saying that word.
Escapism. Yeah.
Escapism. I kept adding on that extra ism.
Yeah.
But I think that that's what it speaks to. Like when I'm reading something with Quentin, I've found him, we'll get into this with the character, but he is very relatable, at least for fantasy, a lot of fantasy readers. Right. I feel like they can connect with that feeling. And, you know, it's interesting to see the rootedness of depression or at least unhappiness in him, in needing that, why he goes to Fillory when he goes to those places. Because we are dreaming about something that could be better. And maybe that world can give it to us and what we can bring back from that world into our world. Yes. So just interesting way to set that up for the fantasy.
Well, and one thing I want to talk about too, because I'm thinking of the listeners and what you said, because I agree. I do think this is primarily a worldview story. And I want to talk about why, because we have analyzed Harry Potter as action. So if I'm a listener, I might say, okay, what's the difference? Because they both have worldview. They both have action. And so we need to ask, like, what is the difference and how would we decide what our stories are more about? So in Harry Potter, there's this big identity thing, right? Like, am I the boy who lived? Do I belong here? Whatever. There's also Voldemort. There's, you know, life and death things that happen on the page, on the surface. In The Magicians, we start out with this big question of like, why am I so unhappy? He tells us in the text, Quentin tells us that he goes to books to escape his depression. He wishes that Fillory could come in and save him from the way that his mind works. He thinks if he goes to another land and if he could find his Fillory, then he would be happy. So he's putting a lot of emphasis on the external to find his happiness. And then throughout the story, which we'll talk about more, but in a second, the plot throws things at him that says, okay, here's what you wanted. Are you getting that happiness or not? And then usually it's like not, but sometimes he does. And then it keeps coming back to this question of, is the other world offering you what you thought you were missing? Are you happy now, Quentin? And so that's what is going to change throughout the story. Where in Harry Potter, he has this internal worldview arc, right? Like he has to accept his past and he has to find the courage to step into who he is and all that stuff. He, you know, find his place, find his belonging. But it's different, right? So it's the weight of the genres feel different. And, you know, Abigail and I like to think about like some of these stories as being equally weighted. So when I say the weight is different, it could be the difference of like 45% one and 55% the other. And then flip it, you know, so it could still be very, very close. But I think what is the emphasis in these opening pages? It's Quentin has this worldview that says if he goes somewhere else to a magical land, all of his problems will be solved. And throughout the story, you see him put his emphasis on different things. Like if I can, you know, now that I'm in the physical kid's cottage, I think I'm going to be happy. Now that I'm in Fillory, I think I'm going to be happy. So it's always brought back down to that through line. Where in Harry Potter, it's kind of always brought down to the through line of Voldemort is out there and something bad is happening. And I don't know if I'm going to survive this. What are your thoughts on that?
No, I love how you executed that. I think that you get that in this first chapter. Even just how a lot of the times, especially in the earlier books with Harry Potter, we have those prologues and disguises.
Yeah.
And even if Voldemort isn't on the page, we are always getting something about that main villain in some way. Harry's Chamber of Secrets is the one that I analyzed really deeply. So I remember it's a lot with Harry dealing with his worst birthday ever at the Dursleys. But there is a chunk that reminds us about Voldemort. And then after Voldemort, we see mysterious eyes. So we're always pulling us back to that. Where in The Magicians, it's not that case. Like in Sorcerer's Stone, it's the opening of the day that Voldemort has been destroyed. Right.
Right.
So I think that with The Magicians, we are being more pulled into what is Quentin going to do with his next steps and why is he dealing with this fascination? Like his obsession of going to the other place. And then what is he going to do with that when he's given it? So, yeah,
and is it true? Like we're wanting to find out too, like, oh, because, you know, again, this is us in a way, right? Like for me, when I'm reading it, I'm like, but does he go to Fillorian? Is he happier? Because I want to know that secret, you know? And then we find out, I mean, spoiler, and we'll talk about the ending, but we find out that's not necessarily the case, right? Like he comes back to the real world. Eventually, he's still not super happy. And we'll talk about that. But yeah, it's a slight difference. And you said something that piqued my interest because I was like, oh, a listener might flag this. What was it? Mm-hmm. Oh, so it was the fact that you didn't really say this, but I was thinking Martin Chatwin is mentioned and he's kind of one of the big villains in this book, right? So he's mentioned, but, you know, he's unlike Harry. Quentin's not necessarily on Martin Chatwin's radar. They kind of have nothing to do with each other. But in Harry Potter, we kind of come in with this built-in villain.
Right.
And we know, you know, once we read multiple books, we know that there's this prophecy that really links them together. And in theory, if Quentin kind of never went to break bills, if he never, you know, went to Fillory and did all this stuff, who knows if Martin Chatwin would have even cared who he was.
Yes.
Yeah. So it's just a different setup. But I do, I love this conversation and I think it's super interesting.
Yeah. And that's also how we can be doing the same but different, right?
Right.
So we have elements of fantasy that we need to satisfy for the reader. And we're seeing those set up in this first chapter with how, especially as you go further and further into the first chapter, you're moving now into this more fantastical world, this more fantastical setting.
Right.
But we're definitely changing up what exactly is the protagonist's role. What exactly is the plot that we're going to explore here on a different percentage level, like you said. So what is the conflict? How big is the conflict going to be?
Right. One more thing on that too. So like if we were imagine writing a setup of Harry Potter, but with a character like Quentin, an 11-year-old boy is not going to be able to think of themselves in this way. So it wouldn't make sense to have the focus be on a worldview story, right? We're not sophisticated enough to be aware of our own worldviews in most cases.
Right.
And to be questioning, why is my worldview this way? Why am I unhappy? You know, to be thinking this clearly about how can I change this or how can I soothe my depressed soul?
Right.
So
right,
it's just an interesting thought exercise.
And that's what, like the sympathetic factor. And I'm going to save this for the character question because it's a better character question. But I want to remind me if I don't, I want to talk about the difference of the sympathetic factor. Like they're both sympathetic, but sympathetic in their different ways.
Right. Okay. So that's where we landed on content genre. We think it's primarily worldview with very heavy action elements. So if they're not equal, then they're really close to being equal is what we'll say.
Which Savannah and I say this all the time, the closer you can get those percentages, the stronger I find the story personally.
Me too. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, that's what when I am saying this is going to be a bestseller, that's what I'm looking for.
Yeah.
All right. So the second question we're going to do with plot, and it's what is the story really about? Right. So we know genre, we know our target reader, you know, the big elements that we're going to satisfy on that, what the reader picks up the book for, but what is the plot about? What is the story actually about?
And so we kind of talked about a lot of this, right? So it's Quentin thinks that magic or that something else besides reality will solve his problems. And, you know, as he goes to break bills, he gets into the magical college, as he goes to, he makes friends, he goes to Fillory, all this stuff. It's whether or not that his hypothesis is true. Then by the end, you know, not to spoil too much of it. I mean, it is 2009 that it came out, so whatever. But basically, he finds out that what he thought was not quite true. danger, bad things happen in the magical world. And both worlds are not black and white. There's bad and good things in both worlds. And regardless of all the magic, that's what we're reading about. We're reading about, you know, what's going to happen to this guy? Is he going to find that happiness he seeks? And then we have a really fun backdrop that this unfolds in.
Yeah. Do you think that that can also be discussed in the realm of like heroes can be villains? Do you think that's something that he starts to learn, or is that not really relevant to this?
I mean, yeah, because he's a little disillusioned with Martin Chatwin.
I only asked that because you had brought up Martin Chatwin.
Yeah. So I mean, I do think that it's basically anything he puts on a pedestal is, whether it's Fillory, other kids, Martin Chatwin, whatever it is, he's learning that things aren't black and white, and that good guys can have bad parts, good places can have bad parts, mm-hmm. reality can have good parts, you know.
Yep.
Just shaking him up.
Right. Right. All right. I have some thoughts, so I'm going to save it again for the character question.
Yeah. We're going to get into character. I know that's going to be a good one.
Yeah. All right. So the third question deals with point of view. And this is, who is telling the story? So right away, we need to know who is telling the story and why is that a great choice for this story?
Yeah. So we're limited to Quentin's point of view, I believe, in the whole book.
Third person limited right now.
Yeah, third person limited. And I think there are a few instances where it kind of starts to hint omniscient, kind of like when we talked about Harry Potter. It's like a few sentences here and there kind of lean that way. But, you know, if I had to say something overall, I think it's third person limited.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
Quentin. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what it's like. I mean, I didn't feel like we got large windows into James.
No,
or
not at all.
Into, you know, the paramedic. Like, we don't get those. If anything's the subtle lines of omniscient might be more narrative in the sense of the big picture. But definitely I felt grounded in Quentin. I thought that was important because we are dealing so heavily with his emotional problems.
Right.
Emotional struggle.
Yeah. And I know we're going to get into this in the next question, but I think we should talk about like how the author painted him in such a way where we understand his mental state. Mm-hmm. But we aren't annoyed by him, because writers are always worse. Like, how do I write a depressed character and not go too far?
Yes. And so, I mean, I think that's a perfect window into that question. So the fourth question is character. And we're dealing with the question of which character should they care about the most? Meaning they as in the readers, what character should the reader, you know, care about the most?
Yeah. So I think there's no question. It's Quentin. We like his friends. I think, to whatever level we want to like them. But we even like the paramedic, but we don't care. We're very invested in Quentin, and that's kind of it.
Yep. So it's interesting because like when you are looking at the introduction of these characters, so probably we have six characters that would be on set see in this. So because we have Quentin, Julia, James, the paramedic, the
Elliot.
Boy who's smoking at the end, and the dead body, right? So we have quite a few characters that we see, definitely. And again, I think the POV helps with this, making us care most about Quentin. For me personally, I found him, of course, like this was the goal, right? Through interiority, I found him the most relatable and have felt a lot of what he has felt.
Right.
You know, so it's like that idea of he's sympathetic in the sense that he does feel like he's the one who's going to get overlooked, right?
Right.
It's, you know, he talks about being why he's kind of frustrated with himself for not being happy.
Like, right.
I'm the middle class. I have a good life in the middle class, he talks about. So why am I unhappy? And how his unhappiness, his only really relief or release from that is to then go to Fillory in his mind and imagine what could be. And I think that a lot of people have done that. You know, a lot of reason why people love certain series and why they read them over and over again is because that world offers them something that they haven't quite been able to satisfy in their real life, the reality versus the, you know, the imagination.
Well, and let me highlight this line that I pulled out because it perfectly goes with what you said. It says, "In Fillory, you felt the appropriate emotions when things happen. Happiness was a real, actual, achievable possibility. It came when you called, or no, it never left you in the first place." Mm-hmm. So like, he totally, you know, thinks that this is the answer. And he, there's even another part that I pulled out. It says, when he's thinking about James, He says, the real problem with being around James was that he was always the hero.
Yeah.
And what did that make you? Either the sidekick or the villain.
Yes, so, like, I love that line.
I do too.
Love
we
it.
Get so much insight into his worldview and to who he is. And like, I mean, even if we're confident people, we've probably all felt this way at some point or another.
Definitely.
You know?
Especially with your best friends. Like, you don't, you know, you love your best friends. But at some point, we also do compare. And if we're feeling in a place of a low, then we're going to, you know, it's, I always think of Taylor Swift's song, Antihero, you know, it's like, I'm the problem, it's me. So you tend to go to that place. I found this really interesting because right shortly after that, let me see if I can pull it up. There's fun, you know, pretty teenagey, like upper teenagery banter between James, Julia, and Quentin, you know, more sophisticated, but immature at the same time banter.
Right.
And, or, you know, I don't know if it's quite crude, but it's, you know, we have some jokes about wangs and things like that.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're like more in that area. But right after he talks about James being the hero, there's this, James is talking about like, why did I eat so much?
Yeah.
And Julia says, because you're a greedy pig, because you're tired of being able to see your feet, because you're trying to make your stomach touch your penis. And then James puts his hands behind his head, his fingers in his wavy chestnut hair, his camel cashmere coat wide open to the November cold, and belched mightily. So it's really funny because this is, they're kind of describing him as sexier, right? Like with his wavy chestnut hair, carefree. And then he belches. And it's like, so for someone like Quentin, it's just interesting to see that from his perspective versus like Julia's perspective or an omniscient perspective, because Julia obviously loves him, you know, and is having that banter. And Quentin's immediate thought goes to cold never bothered him. James, that being.
Right.
Quentin felt cold all the time, like he was trapped in his own private individual winter. So it's just really interesting because Quentin's seeing James as the hero and then he's seeing how free and easy he is. And like that makes Julia laugh. And it's, you know, it's these funny, you know, easygoing type of qualities. And Quentin, and whether or not James and Julia see Quentin as that or not, really is doesn't matter because Quentin sees himself as isolated in his own private individual winter.
Right.
You know?
And he's I think this is really important because he's constantly comparing him to external things, whether it be other people, situations, whatever. And that's he's looking for that compass or that answer outside of himself. And that's what we hope he learns throughout the novel is like, hey, it's not outside of you. You know, you need to find that something, whatever it is, inside yourself.
Right.
And, you know, that's kind of what we want to see. But it is interesting, even on the line level, it's like comparing the words that are used are very effective when it comes to comparing. Also comparing, like you said earlier, is super normal. We all do it, you know, even if we're like totally happy and love our best friends, we still compare. So such a good way to get the reader in his perspective and relating to him.
Right. And that's where it's like I come up when he is comparing himself to James. I don't see it as resentment so much as sadness.
Right.
That's where it's
not
like
going to live up to that.
Right. And then even later when they're about to go into the interview, James says something like James has a strong awareness of when Quentin needs to be pulled out a little bit. And he does it, you know, because you can tell like he cares about his friend. And he talks about, I forget where it is now, but he says something along the lines of like, I know
no one understands you like
no one understands you but me. Like I do. Yes, exactly. And so like you know that there's this deep-rooted friendship with that. At the same time, you can imagine how challenging that would be to be in love or, you know, to be attracted to your best friend's girlfriend.
Girl. Yeah.
It's your friend, right?
Yeah.
So I think that makes him really relatable. The pressures of college, it seems like, the expectations of what he is supposed to be doing versus where he goes is there. And then, of course, dealing with the fascination of the dead body and then being handed exactly like what you were talking about before. The question is more along the lines of what do you do when you're handed
what
everything that you've dreamed about before? And he is given that in the end and starts to go forward with the manuscript.
Yeah.
That he reads The Magicians. But I think that is the big question of the story. Will you change because you are given what you've always dreamed that you could have? And That's a very different question from something like a Harry Potter. To kind of just go back into that, I wanted to mention about the sympathetic qualities. So one of Harry's greatest qualities is his humility, I think, you know, alongside with his courage and his loyalty.
Right.
And Harry, when you meet Harry and Sorcerer's Stone, and he's the boy under the cupboard, you know, so under the cupboard under the stairs, he's this 11-year-old boy who has basically been abused by his aunt and uncle and cousin for his entire life. And he's still not bitter about it. You know, like he's just kind of dreams of more, like, if, you know, yes, it would be great if I could have these things, but you don't see him sitting there and wallowing in his pity, like needing pity. And even when he's given things, I think his humility, when he's the boy who lived, he doesn't want the fame, you know? So that's a big quality of Harry Potter, is his humility. But we kind of see him in this way of not really dreaming that there is a possibility for something better. So that when the letter is handed to him, it's this, oh my gosh, my life could be better than this. Yeah. Here's my way out. And there's a great excitement with that. And then with the magicians, with Quentin, he desperately dreams of something better.
Right.
But are you going to be given it? I mean, what are you going to do with it if it's given to you? Can you change? So it's interesting because we've kind of flipped the question.
Right.
With their situations.
Right. And it's like we said before, it's more age appropriate. It would not make sense either way you flipped it. Right. So like if Harry was a very self-aware 11-year-old, that would be strange.
Right.
I mean, could totally be possible. I don't know, but it
probably
just would be
the
norm.
Though. Right.
Yeah. And then if we flipped it and Quentin was a 17, 18-year-old boy living under the stairs, not having any agency, being abused by his family, you know, that would be weird too.
Yeah.
So I think it's just really cool. Like you said, it's the same, but different, right? Similar, but different.
Exactly.
I also think it's funny that like Quentin, like he said, he knows the answer to his own problem in these opening chapters. He has a good life. He has the setup for things that other people would want. And he still is seeking more because he has to go into himself to find the happiness.
Yeah.
So it's like if we're paying attention, we kind of already know it's going to go two ways, right? He's either going to accept reality and be happy and find that happiness in himself, or he's still going to be the same by the end.
And that first choice is a hard choice.
Right.
Right. Like that is a hard thing that I think is very relatable to these older ages.
Right.
Because we do have to start to, like, you know, we have to start to figure out. Yeah. We have to take responsibility. We have to start to figure out that, like, life is never going to be all fun and games. And what do you do with that? Right. So,
well, and also, like, you know, I've gone to therapy before and they tell you that, you know, if it's bad things, you can't blame other people. If it's good things, you can't attribute them all to other people. It's about how you react to things. Right. Mm-hmm. And so it's funny because Quentin, throughout the whole story, even now when we meet him on page one, whether it's bad or good, it's like not in his hands. Right.
Right.
Except there, it's like there's this kind of, I'm not equal or I'm not as good as these other people. But then when bad things happen, sometimes he blames himself and sometimes he blames other people.
Right.
When good things happen, it's like, you know, I'm less than, but also other people are more than. So it's just really interesting. Like, no matter what, it's, there's still like, you know, he's still not getting to the answer.
Right.
If it's good or bad, he's still questioning everything. He's really interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, it again, just really speaks to a very realistic a really realistic mirror of what I think people in this age category could be going through.
Right.
Okay, so let's move on to question five. Question five deals with setting.
Yeah.
And that question is, where and when does the story take place? So setting is, I think, really interesting for this, Savannah, because we are given the different fantasy setting. That is what we're changing a lot.
Right.
But it's also kind of tips the hat off to, as I mentioned, I think like at least the entrance of it, a Narnia-esque feel, right, in my opinion.
And I'm pretty sure the author said that Fillory, the books and all this were based on Narnia or his obsession with Narnia.
I mean, it's so, like, it's good. Like that's the juggernaut of these portals, right?
Right.
So, yeah. Okay.
But so yeah. So we're
about setting.
Well, we're in Brooklyn, New York, right? And it's during his final year in high school because we know he's going to college. We know it's November. It says that in the text. And then specifically, we are going into a man's house. So this is the guy that's doing the interview for Princeton. We go through, you know, the Brooklyn streets, through an overgrown garden, and then we end up on the grounds of Brake Bills. So we get all of that in this first chapter, which is amazing.
Yeah. And also why I think this, when we break down the scenes, we'll see why it's complicated.
It's a doozy.
Yeah. But I also just want to pull out something real quick. I think it's page, I have a printed copy, so I don't know what the Kindle version would be. But that's page fine. 6, he talks about when Quentin needs to, when he needs to break away from his reality and let his mind wander into Fillory.
Yeah.
And then there's a page break and it says Christopher Plover's Fillory and Further as a series. And it ends with, it never left you in the first place. So it's not even quite 2 pages, but it's page 6 and 7 for me. And I thought it was interesting because we do break off to get a very detailed description of Fillory in the setting, which we then get, you know, bits and pieces of as he starts to enter it at the end.
Right.
So I thought that was a really interesting way to set up this world in a way that wasn't just dumping on us details for detail's sake, because they're satisfied. Also, at the end of that chapter, we're excited because we see the obsession starting to become true.
Right.
I think that this was really, you know, stylistic in how it did this, because setting is so important for this story. So it was important to pay attention to have more description and details of setting in this first chapter. Where if you were in another novel where setting is important, but not maybe to the significance, the level of significance as this book, you probably wouldn't need this much description of a setting in your first chapter. But in fantasy, setting is usually immersively important. So you will see more descriptions of setting in the first
chapter. Also, because it's a portal fantasy, he had to do kind of heavy lifting on 2 settings, right? So we weren't getting to Brake Bills until the end of the first chapter.
Right.
So we did have to give some kind of hint at Fillory. It makes sense because Quentin's also obsessed with Fillory. So it's not random. It's not weird. It adds to the character. It adds to the setting. It adds to the plot.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's head into question 6. So question 6, now we're going to deal with emotion. And the question is, how should they feel, they again being the reader, about what's happening?
Yeah. So I always like to think about kind of 3, when I'm looking at fantasy, 3 main emotions, and it's curiosity, concern, and wonder. In all stories, maybe we're not trying to evoke wonder, but in fantasy, we definitely are. So in this first chapter, I'm concerned about Quentin because we know how unhappy he is. There's no question. We know he longs for something more, which again, I think is relatable. We're curious about the strange interaction with the paramedic, the envelope with the manuscript, and about this new place he's arrived at. So there's, you know, a lot of curiosity being evoked. We're also curious about, like, how is he going to turn out? So we're curious and concerned about Quentin. And then there's wonder because we hear about Fillory, and the text evokes similar feelings of wonder in us as fantasy readers, you know? And then at the end of the chapter, he goes through a portal and we don't understand what has happened. So considering the rest of the book, I think these are the 3 perfect emotions to feel in the beginning. What do you think, Abigail?
Well, I think that you executed that beautifully.
I also thought about it a lot.
Yes. Well, I can tell it was very well articulated. I also think that, you know, that intrigue is the one that I really hinge on as well as the emotional appeal of this I've talked about before.
Yeah.
I am concerned for his emotional state. It's very difficult to pull yourself out of depression when you're in it, or at least unhappiness when he's in it. And especially since he doesn't understand why he's in it, you know, so there is that concern and that sympathy that I have for him. The dead body on the page, and this could just be because of over a decade studying stories. I'm going here and I'm saying to myself, there is no way that this can just be a coincidence when this interviewer for Princeton alumni had this manuscripts of the magicians. Like, there has to be something in there. Now, I'm asking this almost to pose you a question because I am very intrigued, and I see that there are also life and death stakes in that way potentially. Because is this dead body just a dead body, right? Or is there a bigger game at play here?
So,
and you won't see. I don't remember. So you have to answer this.
Yeah, this is where I get confused on the show versus the book, because in the show, I believe it's used as more of like a setup to bring the paramedic who ends up being Jane Chatwin together mm-hmm. with Quentin. But I think in the book, she's been, I know either way, she's been watching him. So she's, this is her chance to kind of get in and see if he's the guy that is going to solve the problems.
And we also we see that, right? Because I think that when you're seeing, it's her that I think you're sitting with and you're asking yourself, yeah. There has to be more to her. There's a lot of attention spent on her. Yeah,
it's her more than the dead body. I think the dead body is an opportunity for her to get in there. But yeah, there's nothing like, you know, evil going on with the dead body.
No, but it's like almost when you're first reading this, probably as a reader, at least I know when I'm reading this, I'm questioning, is there more to this?
Yeah.
But
and
the
I think
attention,
you should be. Yeah.
And, right. And it's like, so that's interesting, right? And then the attention is put on the paramedic, especially because in a very smooth way, because we have Quentin wishing that Julia would look at him the way that she looks at James. And then he talks about why does the paramedic have to be attractive? Like, you know, he's attracted to her.
Right.
So it's interesting because like we're kind of smoothing it over with here it is. Like we have he's locking in on certain details of this, but the dialogue exchange is lighthearted and they kind of like, well, at least like for the paramedic, right? And she says something about why would you be sorry you didn't kill him type of thing. And then he's thinking about that. He's like, well, you know, I think that just by being a human, you'd be sorry that someone died. So it's interesting. There is a tension spent on the dialogue exchange between the two of them.
And we don't know that she's feeling him out, you know, for other reasons. But I do think it's funny that Quentin notices that James notices their interaction. And he's just like, you know, for once in my life, someone's more interested in me than James. Mm-hmm. So they're like Abigail's saying, the way that our attention goes is we kind of skip over like, what could this paramedic be about? And we're focused on like, ooh, this must feel good for Quentin. Oh, I wonder how James is feeling, you know, whatever. We're focused more on the surface, which is, I think, artfully done.
And James kind of gets grumpy after that.
He does. Well, and I think he also gets grumpy, which is really interesting because Quentin takes the envelope.
Yes.
And it's almost like James was unwilling to kind of do the adventurous thing or the, you know, he was unwilling to take that action. So he might be comparing himself to Quentin a little bit.
And that's where I think, how should they feel about what's happening? That really starts to overlap now with this last question.
Yeah.
I like to relate this to stakes. They're, you know, we're looking at the hook as well with this question.
Right.
We're looking at premise as well with this question. But why should readers care about what happens next? And I think that that decision right there is what we're really hinged on, is when Quentin says yes and James says no. And you can almost see like James regretting it in that moment.
Right.
But Quentin is not, right?
Right.
It's like
he's still hoping for adventure.
Right.
And I think like that's why personally I care. It's like, at that point, you know, I feel the same as him, especially when he goes through and he's at Break Bills and he sees Elliot. You know, I'm excited for this new adventure. I'm skeptical because, like, I'm just like Quentin, right? Could this be too good to be true? But I'm also hopeful that I'm going to go on the same adventure that Quentin gets to go on. And maybe there will be happiness and fillery, you know?
Exactly. This is your chance to find out, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Awesome. So that concludes the key first chapter questions.
Now, which was a lot already.
Yes, which was a lot. So now we're going to dig into scenes and we'll do this as concisely as we can.
Yeah.
But ultimately, I found this challenging to figure out where are we breaking up scenes. And I told Savannah, I think I see a lot of scenes sliding into scenes.
Yeah.
And then it's just a matter of, but I will say scenes do exist, right?
Yeah.
You have to have a first chapter with scenes, ideally, right? So there are sometimes prologues that don't necessarily have a scene, and then you'd move into what is the first scene, the first chapter. This one, I think we're having multiple scenes.
Yeah.
And Savannah and I were debating between, is this two scenes? Is this three scenes? We can see arguments for each. We don't necessarily have, I'm super 1,000% confident. This is my final answer.
Yeah.
$1 million answer. So we'll go into it and just pull it apart and give our thoughts on that.
Yeah. And we also did this on purpose because we wanted to show what happens. Like, we're not always sure. And that's okay, because what we're going to land at is, why does this work? So, you know, I think I see this firsthand a lot in my course and my membership, where people are like, but where exactly does it start and end? And it's like, okay, but is that really what we want to focus on? Or is it the arc of change and kind of the the conflict and the decision and the things that are more important than like what actual word does the scene start and end on.
Right.
So we kind of wanted it to be a little messy just to show A, that we don't always have the answers, and B, you might not either. And what can you still take from your analysis? So yeah, we're going to figure out whether this is our hypothesis is two or three scenes. We do have arguments for each. I think Abigail and I are pretty much in agreement on the first scene. So we think, and we like to think about this in terms of goals, right? So one of the things, kind of talking all over the place, but one of the things we like to look at is goals. So we say, what are the goals that we can identify of the scene within within this chapter, right? So the very first thing we know that Quentin's doing is he's going to his Princeton interview, right? So how will we know that that is achieved or not? He's either going to complete the interview or he's not, right? So we can start building out the structure around that question and that answer. So this is where we kind of agreed that we have one scene, and it's, you know, Quentin and Elliot, or Quentin and James and Julia, they go to this man's house for the interview. So all the stuff in the beginning is more or less a setup. The inciting incident, and Abigail, you can jump in if you agree or disagree. I think the inciting incident is when nobody answers the door. So they knock once, nobody answers. It's kind of like, this guy's expecting us. We didn't expect nobody to answer. I think the turning point happens when they knock again and the door opens slightly. So, you know, minutes have passed, the turning point, the door opens. And then they face this choice of what to do. So do we call out? Do we go inside? Do we wait? And Quentin realizes that James is really hesitant. And in the interiority, we learn that Quentin's like, this is how those fantasy books start, right? Something strange that doesn't compute happens. And his interest is really piqued. He's like, if this was a fillery book, this would be the beginning, right? So for him, that's kind of the crisis, is like, do I go in or not? The climax, he goes in, and that's the climax. He goes in. The resolution is that he explores the house a little bit, including this cabinet that piques his interest, because again, he thinks it could be, you know, if it was ever going to happen to him, now's the time. Mm-hmm. He explores it. It's not a portal to anywhere cool. It's not a portal at all. And then he turns around and he sees a dead body on the floor.
Yeah.
Any thoughts there, Abigail?
Yeah, I think that I would agree with you in all of that.
Yeah,
I will say, when I was trying to debate, is this two or three scenes? And I had talked to Savannah about this off podcast. I could see why people would think maybe a turning point isn't happening, or maybe an inciting incident isn't happening until we see the dead body, because there's a lot of him moving through, just, you know, getting to the interview. And we talk about goals, right? What is his goal really in this first scene? And say it's to go have this interview at Princeton. Would you agree with that?
Yes.
With this Princeton alumni. So the goal here is, I need to go have this interview. He doesn't even seem like super excited about it, but it is something that he's going to do. And sorry, my 2-month-year-old is now joining us in the call.
Yep.
So if you hear baby squeaks,
welcome to the call.
Okay. If you hear something's happening, the diaper or baby squeaks, then there she is. So, you know, basically when he's moving through that, I'm always looking for what are the significant events and actions or revelations that are now going to interfere with that goal. And I would agree with you. I think that you could end with seeing the dead body. And that's where we're going to see us sliding into the second scene. Originally, when I was looking at this, I was so hinged on the dead body. I was wondering if that was where I go with the turning point or incident when we're seeing that dead body. And then all of this introductory of character, of his fascination with Fillory, you know, really like movement towards that dead body is going to be what works. It's just a really long introduction before an incident or a turning point. But I like Savannah's analysis better. And I think that this will just mean that we're going to split it into probably three scenes instead of two.
Yeah.
And I like that because I do think that it pulls us deeper into Quentin and his obsessions of wanting something more exciting than what his life currently is.
Yeah.
Which is first called to our attention through his interiority, like you said, when that door doesn't open and then is kind of creaked a jar. So yeah, I liked it.
The other thing I'll say too is it wrong if we said the dead body was the inciting incident? I mean, I don't necessarily think there's a wrong way to interpret this, but the reason I don't stop there or I don't see that as the inciting incident is because there's so much attention paid to Quentin's setup, really thinking that there could be another world besides our own, and he really wants to escape. So it's kind of like, I also wouldn't argue with saying the turning point could be when he sees the cabinet, and then it's like, do I, you know, follow through with exploring this, even though I might be embarrassed, and then he is at the end, or not? Because it's an important decision, because this is what makes him Quentin. I think that's why if we're, and this is why it's, I think, fun when Abigail and I look at it from two different perspectives. When she has not read the story for so many years and she's coming to it, she's naturally going to be more on the surface of what's happening. Mm-hmm. And then when I'm like super nerd over here and engaged in like every single line looking for meaning,
right?
You know, and none of these scenarios are wrong or right, but it's just interesting.
And just to go off of that more, I think that, you know, reinforcing again what we talked about with content genre, I think that can play a role in what you really start to pay, what you start to define as the big commandments. You know, we use the five commandments of storytelling to break down the scene, because you tend to lean into what you believe was prioritized as the greatest, what was prioritized as the greatest importance in the scene level. And if you were looking at what is Quentin really caring about, that would make sense to go more towards that door. You know, something like, not that it can't work this way, but often a dead body on the page, that's going to be loud and it's going to take up a lot of attention, right, quickly. However, look how long it took for us to get to that dead body, and we're not dealing with something like a crime story, which maybe that would be a pretty good, you know, and pretty common.
Right.
Inciting incident for a first chapter in a crime story, not that it can't be the inciting incident for an action or for, you know, maybe even, you know, worldview or, you know, content wise, and definitely not in a fantasy. However, I think that we have to be asking ourselves, what is really upsetting Quentin? And for us, as we're looking over this again and again, like you said, there is no right or wrong answer to this. I doubt Lev Grossman used these when he was
extreme. Yeah.
Right. When he went to his extreme. I don't think his editor probably did. But these are tools that we like to use because it helps us understand how to cut scenes in order to understand how to plan that story while capturing the reader's attention.
And also where to put emphasis. Because if this, like you're saying, if this was meant to be more of an action story or something more like Harry Potter, our emphasis would need to be different.
Yes.
So again, just why it's so important to know genre. So
either
way, I think this was the easier part for us. We're like, okay, we agree that this is the first scene. And by the end of it, Quentin can't accomplish his goal. So that goal window is closed. The interviewer is dead. He's not going to have the interview, right?
Right.
So then the second scene, this is where we had more trouble because there's a few important things that happen. So after this, the paramedics come and he talks to the woman who ends up being Jane Chatwin. She gives him a manuscript. He opens it. He follows the note and he arrives at Breakbills. So this is where we had trouble because we're like, okay, the conversation with Jane Chatwin, the paramedic, is very significant. However, it's a very short little blurb within the chapter. It's like 1,200 words.
Mm-hmm.
So I think what we're kind of landing on is that it's either within the scene where it's kind of like he gets the dead bodies there, he gets the manuscript, and then, you know, his decision leads him to Breakbills. Or it's like the part with Jane Chatwin leads to this decision of, do I take the manuscript or not? And then he takes it, and then it opens up a new scene. So we were torn between those two options, and this is what we really wanted to talk through live. So Abigail, let's think about his goals, because I think that's what's going to help us figure this out. So what do you think his goal is?
Yeah. And I just to, you know, really emphasize that, because I do think whenever you're stuck analyzing scenes, go back to what is the goal.
Yeah.
Because I think that can help you start to figure that out. So after he sees that dead body, when we're thinking about what is his goal, I just want to find the wording of it. Do you remember what page
I do? And I think I know what you're going to say. So he wants to leave. He doesn't want to be involved in this.
So 15 minutes later in the foyer was full of people and activity. Quentin sat in a corner in the cane chair like a pallbearer at the funeral of somebody he'd never met, right? Yeah. So very awkward.
And
kind of like, I feel like I I feel like I have to stay here, but I don't want to stay here.
Yeah. And he even says, like, he's not making eye contact. He says if he didn't move, nobody could involve him in this any further.
Right. Right. And it is interesting because, like, when we get into the conversation with the paramedic and he's saying, I'm sorry, you know, and like and he's having this kind of like side conversation with James about almost feeling guilty. Like, I shouldn't have called him a pedophile, Clinton said out loud. That was wrong. Extremely wrong. James agreed. They spoke slowly, like they were both trying out language for the very first time. They don't know what their place is in this. Right. It's like, you know, like, are we going to be questions? Are we not going to be questioned? Can we just go? Can we slide out the door? Like, it's it's very much in those in that realm. But also at the same time, he's whether or not this is a, you know, brutal dead body, which it's not in that case. We're not dealing with like a mass murder here or not. Seeing a dead body is shocking, right? I think that especially the younger you are, the less death that you've encountered, hopefully, that's something that's you're going to not really know what to do in that situation.
Right.
And that's, yeah. So I think that's really what the goal is here. So then it's a matter of how is he going to go about having that goal interrupted, or how is he going to achieve that goal? Right.
And I also think it's kind of, we have to zoom out too, because we could say his goal is to just not be involved. But does at this point, would we say his goal is to like leave and go home? Or do we think that comes later?
Mm-hmm. I see what you're saying.
Because this will determine what we do.
Yes, I guess that's true.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think he's more immediate right now. I think it's not necessarily because I don't, when he leaves this building, do you think that there's a sense of him really having a goal of I'm just going to go home?
Yeah. So there's a part where right below where he said, when they're kind of like, James says, this is bad. Quentin says, extremely bad. And then he says, if he didn't move, nobody could involve them. And then below that, he wondered when it would be all right for them to leave. He couldn't get rid of the feeling of shame. So he wants to avoid negative feelings and leave, right?
Sure.
And then, so he wants to leave. And then like later on, it says, how's he going to explain this to his parents? So I think he's kind of thinking like, I've already been gone a while. And the reason I'm putting emphasis on this is for two reasons, because when he follows the note into the garden, that's kind of when it's like he's not going home, or when opens the manuscript, he's not going home.
That's right.
And then I'm thinking like backing up from that, if his goal is to just get out of here, yes, the paramedic gets involved in that and prevents him from getting out of here, but he still does decide to leave. So are we saying that he leaves and he accomplishes his goal of getting out? Or is it that the goal is he wants to leave and go home and like get away from this situation? And then everything's kind of a complication to that, you know?
I see what you're saying.
And I don't know the answer for sure, but...
Yeah. I mean, if I had to pick, I lean towards he just needs to get out of this building and then there's a new goal of go home. Yeah. And that's where I'd say like we have a very short scene that then we have another scene before the chapter ends.
Yeah. So let's analyze it that way just for fun. And then we can maybe come back on top of that and say, if we were to do this as one scene, what would that be?
Sure.
So let's say that his goal is to just get out of this situation, whatever that means, like literally leaving the situation.
Right.
So
what's going to interrupt that then is going to be questioning, right?
Right. Just like the fact that they can't, and the paramedic kind of taking an interest in him, right?
Yes.
Well, and kind of James, well, they're both kind of talking, right? But the paramedic announces he's dead and they're like, what happened? Cerebral hemorrhage. Nice way to go if you have to go, which he did, must have been a drinker. So she's like drawing them into the situation, which is opposite of his goal.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And so then the turning point, what would we say that would be?
Well, I think it's when she hands him the envelope.
Yeah, I do too.
Because then that pushes him into the decision of, do I take it or not?
Right. And he even, again, he's comparing himself to James. So he says something like he's even more inclined to take it because he knew James wouldn't.
Right.
Right. So then if we're going on that train of thought, the climax is he takes it. And then the resolution is he accomplishes that goal of getting out of here, because now him and James are outside on the stoop and James, they're upset at each other and they part ways.
And just to reinforce why Quentin is the character that we care about the most, I think that comparison again of he takes it partly because he knows James won't. That is something interesting to say about him. He takes this because James is more satisfied with his life than Quentin, it seems like, right? So he doesn't need that envelope to fix anything. And Quentin sees this as his adventure. So he doesn't know what's in that, but he's going to take that. And we're going to follow Quentin because he has more to gain and more to lose than James does.
Yeah, everything's always a possible escape for him. So we could say that closes out the scene, right? And they've parted ways. Now Quentin's alone. He's also got what he doesn't know yet is a ticket to a different world because he does have the manuscript. So then let's carry on that train of thought. So that would be scene two. I do think it's valuable to look at that as scene two because the interaction with the paramedic is so significant to what pulls him into the conflict later with the Chatwins.
And we find out that she's not just a paramedic too. Like there is definitely attention spent on her that as a reader, subconsciously,
we know something's up.
Subconsciously or consciously, you're expecting something to pay off with that.
Right. Okay. Yes, I agree. And so then scene three, his goal we're saying now specifically is like he's accomplished his goal of getting out. So now he wants to go home. He's thinking about how am I going to explain this to my parents? Right. So the conflict that gets in the way of that is what's in the envelope.
Yeah, what's in the envelope. Exactly. Yeah. So that's where I would say the incident is probably opening the envelope and seeing the manuscript.
And seeing it's book six of Fillering Further, which we know because he's told us there's only five books. Right. So then the note we know flies out of the book. It flies into this garden. He follows it. And then he gets to a point in the garden, which I think is a turning point where he says, like, he thinks he's going through poisonous plants, possibly. And then in the text, it says he stopped. All of a sudden, it was quiet. No car horns, no stereos, no sirens. Yep. His phone had stopped ringing. It was bitter cold and his fingers were numb. And it literally says, like, turn back or keep going.
Yep, exactly.
Which is the crisis.
And what is really interesting about that, just real quick, Savannah, I think that I could see people arguing, well, is the inciting incident when the letter gets ripped out of his hand?
Yeah.
Or is it when he opens the envelope? But I think opening the envelope, because that is where his intrigue is really peaks the most.
Right.
And then when the letter gets ripped out of his hands, it's based on his goal of going home, though.
Right.
Because then when the letter gets ripped out of his hands, we have a complication because this is now interfering with what's excited him. Right. But if you had a different goal, then maybe you would be arguing something different. And again, there's no perfect answer to this, but why can we argue why something works or not doesn't work? Because we can see how it could be executed in the way that we're seeing this play out.
And we'll talk about that because I do want to do a version if these two scenes were one scene just for fun. So hang on to your hats.
Yeah, sure.
So the climax is he keeps going. Like he says, turn back or go. He keeps going. And the resolution is he arrives at this on this grassy green and he sees a boy smoking a cigarette.
Yep.
So obviously he's changed locations. He's been pulled into the conflict. He doesn't know that yet, but he is. And he's getting what he thinks he wants. So he's getting a new world where happiness could be possible. So now just
is
for
this
fun.
Fillery? No.
Yeah. Upstate, yeah. He even says, is this fillery? Like he's still hoping that. But just for fun, let's think about because I know there are people out there that are going to like to nerd out more on this.
Yeah.
Let's go back to in the house and let's say if his goal was at that point to like leave and go home, right?
Sure.
We could analyze this as one whole scene instead of two separate scenes. And I think it would just be, you know, very similar, right? So the paramedic is talking to him. She hands him, you could say that handing him the manuscript is the turning point or opening the envelope is the turning point, whatever.
Right.
It gets him to the same spot.
Yes.
No matter how you analyze it. So I think that's what's really cool is that if Abigail showed up and said, I think it's one scene and I thought they were two, we would still end up at the same answer, which is the point of the scene.
Right. And then again, it's just you're changing that analysis based on what you think his goal is initially, but the events to get him to where he needs to go.
Right.
Or meaning the also, same as maybe in a different order of importance. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. And also the genre, like this is what I'm getting at. Spoiler to my own thoughts coming in 5 seconds. But a lot of writers will spend a lot of time on their opening chapters going like, well, what is the inciting incident, turning point, whatever. And then if they don't know the rest of the story, you can't know where to put emphasis and where not to. So, you know, your first version, this chapter might contain two scenes, just like we said in the second example. And then when you come back to it, you might say, hey, that part with Jane Chatwin's really significant. I need to expand that. I need to add in commandments to that part. It's really going to be three scenes. that's something you might not know until you get to the end of your draft. So either way, like, I think what I'm trying to say is that if you, no matter how you look at it, the point is still the same because you're thinking about it on that higher level. And then you can go back and kind of fine tune it and put the emphasis wherever you need to.
I think that's a really valid point, especially because exactly that. Like, I am a huge advocate of knowing your story ending before you write your book.
Yeah.
Because I think it's going to greatly change everything.
Right.
What is it? There's a T.S. Eliot quote that says, what we call a beginning is often the end, and to make it end is to make a beginning.
Yeah.
You know, so really in that line of, once you know your end, your beginning is going to change, and what you, you know, what you elaborate on in detail is going to alter based on what you need the reader to know to move forward in a satisfying and cathartic way.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I love that you did that challenge, Savannah, because we do, we get there. And if I were to analyze it as the two scenes as one scene, I think you could even still argue that the incident sin is maybe being handed the envelope. Did you say the turning point is opening it? The turning point might also still be the letter getting ripped away. Like, the goal is that, like, what is drawing him towards? Would you agree that then, like, the crisis still needs to be about, do I go forward or do I not?
I mean, it could be, but also I wouldn't be mad if you said to me the crisis is open the envelope or not, take the envelope or not. Like, either way, we're getting him. The results are still going to be the same.
Right. And I think that's the thing. It's about going forward, right?
And this is what, like, people, I feel like, want to argue a lot about. I mean, not with me. I'm not saying anybody argues with me. But it's like, we want to overanalyze and argue with ourselves that we have to pick the right thing. And it's like, actually, you need to know the point of what you're doing.
Yes.
And
yes,
then that's the only thing that matters, not how you describe the arc of change necessarily. It's just, is it appropriate for what you're trying to do? And then it's not necessarily like the end of the world if you call something an inciting incident and I call it a turning point. The fact of the matter is it delivering on the point you're trying to get across?
That's right.
Yep, so exactly, I like pointing that out because people spend way too much time like really overanalyzing it. And when we're writing our first and second and even third drafts, we're not going to have all the stuff to analyze like we're, you know, seeing in the text, because it's been through multiple rounds of revisions and rewrites, right? So it's like, when you're first analyzing your own scenes, you might just realize your conflict doesn't escalate or that you don't have a turning point. And that's really valid. Like, it's still very valid to go through the exercise, but don't get so bogged down in the nuances of, you know, the different things.
Yeah. And that's also why when I'm coaching writers, I like to say, we're going to use these five commandments as editing tools.
Yeah.
Because you can use that as a strategy to plot out scene by scene. But sometimes I see people go so micro in the planning stages that it really paralyzes them because they, I don't know, you need to allow things to evolve, I guess.
Yeah.
And so, you know, exactly what is the point of the scene and how can you best execute that? Are the details in there? There's might be shifting when you actually write the scene with it. But I do think that it's valuable. You need to know why one scene leads into the next. What is that cause and effect trajectory?
Right.
So that I think you need is the planning tool.
Yeah. And we in Notes to Novel, my course, we do goal conflict decision because at certain points, like, we don't need to go so far in the weeds. So, you know, feel free to take that as a listener and then come back around. If you're, you know, let's say you're reading a scene in your story and you're realizing the conflict doesn't escalate properly, then you can go in and say, okay, well, what is the inciting incident? What are those rising complications? And then what is the turning point? You know, so choose your own adventure, pick up and put down whatever tools you want. But yeah, I think no matter how we analyze this, we get to the same place. But our instinct is to say there are three scenes within this first chapter.
Yep. Yep. I agree with that.
And hopefully listeners can see how we got there and whether or not you totally agree with her logic, as long as we're, for anybody listening, as long as anyone's able to defend and kind of explain how they got to their answer, I think we're all good to go.
1,000%. And if you didn't get this, I'd love to hear from you. I'm sure Savannah would love to hear from you. We always love to continue to nerd out about scenes. This is what we saw. Maybe you didn't see it that way. What did you see instead? You know, so let's continue this discussion off this podcast episode. So
yeah, let us know. You can find us both on social media. I'm at Savannah Gilbo or at Savannah.Gilbo on Instagram. And you are at Abigail K. Perry on Instagram, right?
Yeah, exactly. So maybe we'll see you there.
All right. Thanks, everybody.
Yeah. Thanks, Savannah. This is great. I look forward to doing another deep dive with you soon. And thank you, listeners, for coming in. We always love these discussions. Hopefully you can take something away from this and apply it to your own writing.
Yep. Bye, everybody. So that's it for today's episode. As always, thank you so much for tuning in and for showing your support. If you want to check out any of the links I mentioned in this episode, you can find them in the show notes listed in the description of each episode inside your podcast player or at savannahgilbo.com/podcast. If you're an Apple user, I'd really appreciate it if you took a few seconds to leave a rating and a review. Your ratings and reviews tell Apple that this is a podcast that's worth listening to. And in turn, your reviews will help this podcast get in front of more fiction writers just like you. And while you're there, go ahead and hit that follow button because there's going to be another brand new episode next week full of actionable tips, tools, and strategies to help you become a better writer. So I'll see you next week. And until then, happy writing.